A lot has been happening recently in the AI space. Stability AI, one of the most powerful companies, I believe, in the open source ecosystem and pioneering tons of excellent open source models for the space, is increasingly unstable. There's a huge change in leadership. The CEO has stepped down. Other key talent has left the company. What's happening over there, and what does this mean for open source? And what does it mean for centralized versus decentralized AI? We discuss this along with numerous elements and powerful new features in the AI video generation, how to make best use of these tools, why Anthropic AI may be an undervalued competitor to ChatGPT. We talk about some of the developments in hardware-specific AI applications, and is Apple finally about to make their AI move? All of this and more in today's episode. This is AI Unchained. What is up, guys? Welcome back to AI Unchained. I am Guy Swan, your host, and let this be your lens for how AI will be a tool for freedom and not control. That is why we are here. And today, this week, I want to go over just a lot of development that's happening in space. I've got a couple of reads and I got a couple of interviews that I'm trying to get around to, but I just have so many little just kind of news items, just things that have been going on and things that I'm trying to make sense of and that I'd also love your feedback on, that I really felt like I actually had room for a full episode on just kind of covering news and developments in the space. Because a lot has happened in the last couple of weeks since specifically Sora. Sora is still not available. I have actually signed up and requested permission for it, or requested access with three different emails that all divert to my same email address, and I have not gotten anything yet. So I really, really want to play with it as somebody who was a filmmaker first, and you know that's what I went to school for, and I love film. I am getting back into film. This is just such a powerful tool. I mean, that's why I did a whole freaking episode on Sora and just kind of the video generation stuff. And I've done a lot of recent kind of exploring the alternatives to Sora, because Sora really just kind of blows them all out of the water. And I've been increasingly shocked. I thought the paid-for versions, the Pika Labs and the Runway ML and there's I2V, which this one's also open source or whatever, I2V Gen something, I can't remember. And then there's like Moon Valley. God, why can't I remember the names right now? But I've been looking these things up and going through and comparing a lot of things for how the outputs of each of these things are. And I'm trying to do it without like infinitely signing up with subscriptions to all of these things. Granted, some of these are specifically open source, so you can actually run them yourself, or you can try them out on Hugging Face. But I am shocked by something, and this is also relevant to a news item that is sad, but it might not be a terrible development. Like, it might not mean disaster for the open source AI movement. Actually, one note before we get into it. Well, first, this show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. So if you're trying to get into Bitcoin and you have not purchased your Bitcoin, definitely use Swan Bitcoin. They make it simple and they do Bitcoin only, and you will literally learn everything that you need to know at Swan Bitcoin, especially how to use like a hardware wallet and hold it safely and for the long term. And then CoinKite makes the cold card hardware wallet, which is how you would literally keep it safe. Like, I have three cold card hardware wallets, which is not necessary. You get one and does more than enough. I'm a big fan and I like having lots of hardware wallets. I don't know. I'm stupid. But check them both out. And if you have not listened to this on Fountain, I just want to shout out to people. I've been getting a lot of awesome boosts on Fountain and a lot of great comments from you guys and zaps. Lots of sats that I'm increasingly like, holy crap. Like, you guys are amazing supporters, and it also brings a lot of attention to the show on that app. And if you're not using Fountain, Fountain is freaking awesome. You can actually get paid to listen to shows. So one of the really cool things about like one of their advertising models, and this is something that I've used, I don't market the show practically at all, either AI Unchained or Bitcoin Audible. This is all basically word of mouth. But one of the really fascinating things is that the way the marketing works is that like when I pay a marketing fee, like when I pay to advertise for the show, I'm actually paying you to listen to it. I'm not joking. Like, it's so cool. I'm paying you for your attention. So rather than, I mean, of course, I'm paying some to Fountain as well, but the sats go in so that every minute or every few seconds, I can't even remember exactly how they bring it, break it up, but literally it streams sats to you to pay you for your attention, to just give the show a chance, which I just found so fascinating. And it's clearly something that can only happen with Bitcoin and Lightning. And Fountain has exploded. I mean, just exploded. They're like 16, somewhere between like 16 and 20% of my audience now. So anyway, that's just a long thank you to everybody who supports me over there. And also, if you haven't checked it out, or our sponsors for the show, you definitely have to. You have to get on Fountain, get yourself a cold card, and buy some Bitcoin on Swan. But anyway, back to the news item. So I said it's maybe a sad news item, but there might be a hint of some really cool developments or some really cool shift happening in the space that I'm going to get to in just a bit. But stability or stable diffusion video, stable video, is actually really good compared to the others. I mean, it's nothing compared to Sora, or at least what I've seen of Sora. Obviously, I haven't been able to play with it myself. And honestly, I think the big reason why it's not public is I think we're running out of two things. I think we're coming up scarce on two different items for the AI industry right now. And I think it's energy and computation. And something like Sora is going to just be a massive, massive undertaking, a massive cost of computation. And like, I would not be surprised if when it does come out, they put it at something like $100 a month. Like as a service provider, and I don't mean that like, oh, they're going to be evil and they're going to be greedy. Like if I was releasing it, I might even do more than that. I might do it at like $200 a month just because of the overhead of doing it and the ability to scale with users. You got to put in a barrier, man. You got to put in something where when 90% of the users go to the website to sign in or to get a subscription to the thing and pay for that subscription, especially if you're going to have like a free set of tokens or something where you can generate 5 seconds or 10 seconds of a video or something, because their model specifically in Sora go up to 60 seconds. So you would have to put a huge cost on it. You would have to put a huge cost on it just to slow down the amount of people flooding in. And so you could have some degree of feedback time on scaling up your computation. Now, for the sake of this show and for using it and for playing around with it, having YouTube content and everything, I would probably pay $200 a month until it felt like I didn't have any concrete use for it. But I think really with a lot of projects that I have, I think it'd be worth it. I think it would be worth it. I think it would let me change. It would let me do so much more because I could change the way that I thought about filming and getting shots and framing, lens focus, like all of the things that I would want to be very deliberate about. And I know the size of a crew that it would take me to do, or I'm slightly aware. It's been a long time since I've been on a real production set, and you know, most of my projects in the last 10 years or so have been very, very small. Like they've been, you know, 2-man crews, 3-man crews, and you know, two subjects, like in the thing. Like it's mostly been like little music video stuff, and it's just stuff for fun, really, more than anything. It's probably a 15-year timeline that those have basically been the only projects I've been doing. But in thinking about the shots that I would want to get and the things that I could do with this tool, it just opens up so many things. It opens up so many things just in Oh my God, the framing, the ability to use it's like Control Net on Automatic 1111 or Comfy UI is being able to use Control Net for the image diffusion. Like that's such a huge thing because you're taking the composition of a photo or the depth map. Depth map is a re well, depth map is one of the control mats, right? You have the pose, open pose, you have the depth map, and a couple of other like the outline drawing or whatnot. That one's not so great. I find the depth map and the open pose are the best. Open pose obviously just specifically for getting people, but that's why I like the depth map, is that you could it brings a whole new idea or a whole new meaning to like miniatures and how you could get a shot, how you could create an environment that would be viable even for small shots, even for small, even if you wanted to focus on like with stable video being the example, not having a brilliant, not having a Sora level video generator, but being able to make like a Gaussian blur, a Gaussian map of these things, which is another kind of AI based tool that will take a 2D image and turn it into a 3D map. So it just has depth. But if you try to change the angle too much, you can tell that there's not you don't actually have the side of the thing, but it's just enough to create like a little bit of movement, like 5 seconds of someone walking in a scene. And if you've got like a high quality image, you can make that look real. It's incredibly powerful the way that you can combine some of these tools if you have the compositor's mind. If you know how you can use the editing tools, even though this isn't even integrated with a lot of the things yet. And I've been trying to figure out how to pull these things together to use in DaVinci Resolve and like their whole suite, because that's the one that I've gone to since I started. All my pretty elaborate meme making Fusion and their node system is just phenomenal. If anybody's looking for a really solid editor, and they do have some AI things, and I'm not sure when they'll start implementing heavily a lot of these other things. But being able to use like the Gaussian things, you can export as a 3D environment, so you can use them with a camera or with a virtual camera and actually treat it like that. But if nobody's using DaVinci Resolve, I have the pro version, but the free version is insanely powerful. Like it's a full-fledged editing suite even without the pro version, and it's not like one of those things where you're going to constantly run into a thousand little things where you're like, you need the pro version for this, and then unless you use a tool, and then like you get to the end, and you're trying to export. It's like, oh, sorry, you're using a pro tool, and you don't even know it. I've run into that with CapCut, and I just want to scream. Like, thank you for not respecting the amount of time that I've put into this, and not even making it clear that I'm using some sort of a tool in my toolkit. It's just like right there on my toolbar, no delineation that this is pro. Any whatever. I'm not here to complain about CapCut or my video editor. But the thing about Sora is being able to create cohesive video by using the framing and the composition and the elements of a different video, like just walking in front of a green screen and being able to recreate that walking in another character that looks completely different, that you can give a face and an outfit or whatever it is, a consistent character, and then replacing that green screen, which is really easy with AI when you're just talking about, like, you don't even have to think about the green screen. You just use it as a backdrop to have a flat, flat background, and then do like a Gaussian blur environment and put those things together. But here's the kicker, is that you can kind of shoddy put them all together. You get a good Sora level video of the walking. You do a something like magnific.ai, I believe, is the thing of do a Stable Diffusion generated environment or Midjourney generated environment that you want to use. Then you blow that thing up and do insane high definition with Magnific, and for your environment, then you make like a Gaussian splat or splash, Gaussian splash. I can't remember the hell it's called, but it's that thing that turns 2D into 3D, and then put that in the environment and then compose your shot. And even if your composition is like a little bit, like the edges aren't clean or whatever, that's when you take the whole thing and you put it back in Sora, and then you describe it based on all of the things that you have put into it, and then re-export the whole thing. And the AI basically can clean up all of the edges, can clean up the things that don't quite fit right, can put something real on the side when you push your Gaussian splat thing. What is it called? Why can't I remember? There's something about splat, Gaussian splatter, Gaussian splash. When you like go just a little bit past and you realize that there's not this detail like on the side of the car in the scene, and you're like trying to move through the scene, well, Sora will fill that in. Like the AI will fill those things in. So your 90% rough edges, not fully fleshed out thing, then immediately becomes a fully fledged video with incredible detail and consistent movement and cohesive environment, and you did nothing but film yourself in front of a green screen. Now, there will be some filmmakers who say, oh, that's not real filmmaking. And, you know, to a degree, I even like respect that, is that, you know, I like production out in the wild. But what's sad is that that's already lost. Like Hollywood movies, if you ever watch like some of the, they try really, really hard to make it seem like 90% of that thing isn't in front of just a giant blue screen room, but it is. And you can tell, a lot of times you can tell in the acting, is they don't sell the interaction with other stuff, and they arbitrarily kind of create things in the CG that weren't even there previously. So like they're not really reacting to it. So it's like this, it's all this like fake close calls, you know, like you see that a lot in the Star Wars trilogy, not the newest Star Wars trilogy. It was just like absolute trash. But the prequels, there's so much just like green screen acting. That's how I think about it, is what I call it in my mind, is like, oh, that I watch a whole scene, is like, that is all green screen acting. And they'll just have, like, have them running, and like something like comes by and is like 1 inch away from them. But you realize that was all done in post. It was just like the editor and like the animators or whatever, like, let's make this like a super close call. And like the actors don't react to it at all. Like, there's no indication that they ever saw it, that it was ever there. And because of it, it feels so, it's like you don't, none of the stress, you know, none of the ability to identify with the character's emotions is there, because it's obviously fake. It obviously didn't occur. So it's just kind of like, oh, another close call. And it just becomes dumb, and it just kind of cheapens the whole scene. There's an element there that I understand. So I understand the argument. I am a filmmaker at heart. I love telling stories. I love telling stories. So trust me, I get it. But this is a powerful tool. This doesn't mean that you still just do everything in front of a green screen. I think I use it as an example just to show you what is possible. And it also means that the story becomes the avenue. The story becomes the true value, because the art itself, it's like turning music from a coding project to an instrument. Like, music has a theory. Music has a concrete form. You can it's got patterns, it's got specific notes that will only sound good together in harmony. And you can think about it from a mathematical perspective. And it's fascinating from a mathematical perspective. But when you pick up a guitar, you're not thinking about math. When you make music, you feel it. The next era of these tools that will, we're still in the mathematical theory part of the AI transition. And we are going to get to the place where we play music, where we play these tools into a story. And that is where this is really going to shine. So why do I bring all this up? And I start starting this off with talking about all the video things and stuff we've sort of covered recently. Well, when I was doing my investigation this past week in my spare time, Stable Diffusion Video has basically been one of the best. It's comparable. Really, it's the closest one to Runway ML. And Runway ML sometimes, runwayml.com, by the way, is the website if you want to try it out. And they do let you do a free thing for, you know, a certain number of videos. and you can kind of control net in the sense that you can put in an image and then say, like, make this into video. And it's not perfect, but it is pretty decent. And Stable Diffusion Video is, there are ones that I did, and then there are ones that I saw other people do. I read a bunch of articles and people giving examples of comparing them, so that I didn't have to pay for all of it also. And there were definitely times where I was like, wow, out of all four of these, out of all five of these, the Stable Diffusion Video is the best. And that's saying something, because I've used, like, Animated Diff on Automatic 1111 and Comfy UI, and I have used Stable Diffusion Video, but not at length. I think I had, like, one weird thing with it, and I found Animated Diff to be the better for that one particular, the thing I was trying to generate. And it was just, like, a normal tracking shot through a scene, like moving forward through a scene. And for some reason, I don't know if it was my prompt, but Stable Diffusion Video didn't give me a very good result, so I went back to Automatic 1111 with Animated Diff, and it gave me the result that I was looking for, so I just basically started using that for everything that I was doing. And I think I misjudged or judged too quickly the fact that Stable Diffusion Video was not good, because I have recently come to realize that it's actually one of the best out there, which is crazy because it's open source and there are paid alternatives. Like, Stable Diffusion SDXL is really good, but I still think Midjourney is better. Like, the Midjourney model is a really, really great model. And, of course, it's a closed, paid-for model. So for anybody who is looking to kind of start playing around with the video generation stuff, I would probably recommend Stable Diffusion Video or Runway ML. Those are by far, I think, in almost every example I could find, with very, very few exceptions, one of those was producing the best results. Until, of course, something like Sora is available, or something that competes with Sora is open source, which I think will be a while. So here is the sad news. And I was actually just about to become, like, a premium supporter or member of Stability AI. I can't remember what they call it. But the CEO of Stability AI has resigned. These guys have been the powerhouse of open source models right now. Probably on the LLM side, they do have a stable, I think they have a Stability AI LLM. In fact, I dot AI. Let me see real quick. Models, video. So they do have a language model. It's just one that I haven't really explored. I still think, Stable LM Zephyr. Okay, no, they're the Zephyr model. Of course. Okay, so the Zephyr model is the Stability language model, the large language model. And so that one's, damn, that's a good one too. I still find myself using Mixtral more than anything when it comes to open source and local run models. But Zephyr is a really great option, especially for one that's uncensored and isn't going to try to give you, like, if you're trying to make, like, a bad guy character in a story, ChatGPT is going to tell you you're not supposed to be mean to people and, like, this could be insulting or whatever. So ChatGPT is the worst for anything that's just not, like, super polite or politically correct, whatever the hell you want to call it. I've run into, they won't even let you, like, come up with thesaurus words that have sexual innuendo. It's so stupid. It treats you like you're 7 years old. So Zephyr is a good one to, and Mixtral, especially some of the ones that are fine-tuned to even lower the censorship even further, because there is basically a realm of, you know, try to lean towards nice things and disallow certain conversation or certain results. And sometimes you have a very targeted use case, and sometimes it's specifically because of that. You're specifically trying to do something. You're trying to create a character. You're trying to get some sort of a result or tonality or something that, you know, neutering these things becomes just counterproductive. So those are good options for that if you're doing local versions or local hosting an LLM for yourself. But the stepping down, Imad stepping down, the CEO stepping down, last Friday, is one of numerous kind of crazy upsets that have been going on in the AI space. Sam Altman got kicked out and then forced back in, and half the board got kicked off. There's some bunch of just crazy things have kind of been happening. I think it's because the space is moving so fast and kind of the stakes are so unbelievably high. And it worries me because Stable Diffusion has been such a, I watched that website pretty religiously looking for the next thing that they're coming out with, because they have done such a good job of having an open source model. And Imad, for so many things, and they are kind of the thing for modification and LoRAs and that sort of thing in the kind of the image generation space for the video, which I feel like I haven't even explored as well as I should have. But one of the things that he actually tweeted about, so he retweeted the announcement from Stability AI that he was stepping down. And he says, "We're not going to beat centralized AI with more centralized AI. All in on decentralized AI. Lots more soon." Now, something... The reason... So there's actually been a lot of key talent leaving Stability AI, according to a number of different articles. I didn't look into specifics on who those people were, other than just kind of following a handful of them on Twitter for who I could find. But apparently, there's been a lot of breakup in that company, and then there's been a lot of contention about the COO and the, I think it's the CFO, who were made kind of like interim joint CEOs. And apparently one of them is not fun to work with, or just kind of according to the drama sort of rumors about the situation. And other people, there's rumors or discussions that this didn't fix the situation. This actually kind of made it worse, because a lot of people liked the CEO. But so much of that is speculation. It's hard to say one way or the other. But I tend to think that Imad was probably a really good, strong benefit for the direction and values of Stability AI in for their openness and the ability to release and properly build these things. And it seems that there was some sort of a contention or friction in that forced him or encouraged him to just leave. And I think it lends itself to, especially with the all-in on decentralized AI, is that I think it lends itself to the risk and the chokehold in the corporate environment. And that is what is interesting to me about this situation, is I think their hands were tied on a lot of things that they wanted to do that they couldn't do. And if you decentralize the infrastructure, if you disconnect the models from how it is being run and what it's being run on, they have more freedom. And I chased this thread through a couple of different things and a bunch of different articles. And one of the other things that caught my eye is that there was a big payout of rewards and a lot of stuff happening with Meta, because Meta has just been far and away successful and has been killing it with their AI stuff. And a lot of people are leaving Meta, are kind of walking away from the AI, the AI section of Meta. So Meta is succeeding and apparently losing talent at the same time. And this comment above all of them stood out to me in the stuff that I was kind of finding and piecing together on this. And I thought this was an incredible, this gave me a second context, because this actually was connected to a thread that Imad retweeted. So this is actually how I got back to this, because Imad has been posting a bunch of things, just kind of like showing his intent and where he thinks things are going. And he talks about like the render network, which is basically an enormous amount of GPU power that is collected together to do a lot of these things. So I think this is a really interesting conversation about where this is all going. And I think despite the fact that in the short term, this could be bad for a very, very potent or a very, very important company in the OpenAI space or institution in the OpenAI space, I think it will lend itself to far more freedom and far more expansive use and application of AI that can't happen if we don't get out of the corporate environment. And this, let me read you this tweet really quick to see. This is Eric Meijer, I don't know how you'd say it, says, "Folks, I left Meta yesterday. This time, there were no layoffs or anything thrilling involved. In fact, I am more bullish than ever about Meta with the company's increased focus on AI. But given the incredible competitive pressure in the field, this is the kicker. There is really no advantage to be inside a large corporation if you want to build cool stuff on top of LLMs. My current plan is to keep an empty calendar and mess around doing independent research and see where it leads." That line has stuck with me since I read that. Given the incredible competitive pressure in the field, there is really no advantage to being inside a large corporation if you want to build cool stuff on top of LLMs. So one thing that I've talked about on this show, if you've listened to this for any length of time, is that the corporate models are going to neuter themselves. But because we're in this space, we're in this weird apex where a lot of technology is shifting, a lot of new protocols, Bitcoin, the Lightning Network, Pair, Nostr, and the Pair Stack, like these things have come into fruition. Things that people have been trying to build for 10, 20 years, and we're kind of finally seeing sort of the application layer. We're seeing these things engaged, implemented, and integrated into things, into actual tools and applications. I think we're reaching the point where the corporate environment is becoming so bloated, so choked of creative energy, and so constrained in what they can, just the freedom of how they can act, that we might be looking at the rise of a very different environment and mode of organization, of kind of free-floating organizations, where people can easily work together, they can organize in a more distributed fashion, and kind of free themselves from the corporate restraints. And I think a lot of these people might, like, we might be looking at an era or a zone where kind of formal systems, formal modes of doing these organizations, of collecting and pulling together all of the infrastructure for this, and separating the models themselves from the infrastructure, from a centralized system, and fixing that kind of top-down hierarchical problem that does constrain so much what people can actually do with these, which I think is going to lend itself to people leaving. And I think it's going to make people leave because people want to be doing something meaningful. People want to be doing, especially in the era of bullshit jobs. If you haven't read the book Bullshit Jobs by David Graeber, actually, the same guy who did Debt. This show is brought to you by CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet. If you are looking for a way to secure your Bitcoin, know that you own it, to get it off a computer where the keys can be extracted because of an overflow bug and a RAM attack in the actual CPU, in the actual chip itself, which, if you don't know, recent development has found that the M series of the MacBooks, they can basically brute force tiny little pieces of the key in just a couple of hours. They can get a 2048 RSA key that is completely encrypted. And it's a side channel attack. So they're not brute forcing the actual key. They're not doing anything with the cryptography. They're pulling small amounts of information over and over and over again. This is why you get a cold card. This is why you get a hardware wallet and you separate your keys. This is why you treat your hot wallets as hot wallets. You do not put an enormous amount of value on them because there's nothing. At the end of the day, these devices are not your normal computer, your normal phone just are not going to be secure enough to hold your lifelong savings. But if you get a simple hardware wallet, you get a cold card hardware wallet, get a cold card queue, even get a tap signer. That one's beautiful and it's so easy to use with my phone. My keys for the overwhelming majority of my coins are safe from my devices, even though I can easily access them on those devices. And that is a godsend. It lets me sleep well at night. It lets me just casually say that M1 Mac, you know, devices or M series Mac devices that I am working on right now, that these are vulnerable to key extraction and I am not panicking. Why? Because I have a cold card and I'm not stupid. I got to hear about that news and go, oh, wow, that sucks. I hope other people bought themselves a cold card. I'm going to get back to work. If you want that to be your reaction to massive hacks and massive vulnerabilities in your devices, that's what I recommend. Get a cold card, and even better, you can get a discount with code BitcoinAudible. You'll find the link and the details right in the show notes. Keep your Bitcoin safe. Grab a cold card. Yeah, I think that's right. David Graeber did the debt the first 5,000 years and bullshit jobs. But man, it is such a, even though he doesn't understand, it seems pretty clear that he doesn't fully grasp what I think is the cause of this, which is the fiat imbalance in the economy and the fact that things that shouldn't be profitable are profitable because we don't have a legitimate pricing mechanism. We have a fake money. We have a fraudulent money. But regardless, if you haven't read Bullshit Jobs, you definitely need to. I will have a link in the show notes. I love that book. I think it's very, very eye-opening of the spiritual toll, the current current structure of our economy, what it has done to us. And here's why I think it applies contextually to what we're talking about here, is this is really exciting stuff. And I think people want to build stuff that is meaningful, that pushes the boundaries, that tests, that stresses our limits. And I think there's just too much choking the corporate environment. And I think it disallows people to work on things that they love and work on the thing that they want to do. Just that comment could not put it more perfectly, is there's no advantage to being inside a large corporation if you want to build cool stuff on top of LLMs. And I think everybody who is in the AI space is here because they're excited, because they see the insane potential of this, and they want to build cool stuff on top of LLMs. That's what they want. And I think this is going to be a huge force because the pressure has been building, because our regulatory and corporate environment is so messy, the incentives are so just messed up. It seems very likely that a shift is happening. And this would make me very, very happy. And I don't want to just think that this is happening because it would be great for me, like for my perspective or my narrative or my values, so to speak, on the fact that this is happening. But to know that Imad has left Stability AI seemingly because of, as it sounds like, the trying to get around the centralized hierarchy problem. You know, we're going to compete with centralized AI with more centralized AI, and potentially what has been constraining what he wants to do, that he's going all in on decentralized AI. In fact, his profile description is now just hashtag decentralized AI. That is it. And there was a recent, there's a podcast, I think it was Lex Friedman, and I cannot remember who the guest was, but they were talking about AI, and they said that they thought, and this is something that has been increasingly, it's been my thought as well, just the way these things, the access, I mean, God, just use my, I have a regular, I mean, I built myself an AI machine here, and I'm looking right now, my Linux machine has a different screen, and it's just up, and I'm looking at a folder full of models from God knows, I mean, just so many different models and things. And I have LM Studio with so many different models. I have Ollama. I have image generation models. I have video generation models. I have a huge variety of LLMs. Grok is now open source. That is another. In fact, I just want to go ahead and hit that news item because it's such a big deal. Grok, the Twitter LLM, It is now open source, and I think a lot of people have discounted just how powerful that can be. Llama so far, I feel like, has been the dominant, like, fine-tuning model, in the sense that if I find some custom model or, you know, something that's trained specifically for certain type of weights or reweighted, whatever it is, 9 times out of 10, it's usually a Llama-based model. It's usually Llama 2. That's the meta model, by the way. But the point of all of this is that I think this is going to be commoditized. The guest on Lex's show was saying that intelligence in the context of these models and everything will be ubiquitous. Like, it will just kind of be freely available. It'll be commoditized, and no one will be without an option, and a artificial intelligence option. Like, there will just be, this will be ubiquitous. And I just at the state, we're still, God bless, we're still only like a year and 3 or 4 months into this having basically been released on the world. And I want to share a statistic really quick that I just saw the other day. In fact, I think it was Imad who actually posted this. No, it was not. It was, he retweeted it. So it is from him that I found it. Says, quote, okay, so this is somebody from Stability AI, it seems like. Public policy of Stability AI. Okay, yeah. It says, quote, it's been a roller coaster week here at Stability AI, but we're pleased to share our response to the U.S. government's inquiry into open models. We show that the ecosystem isn't an abstract idea. It is a community of people who are helping to make AI safer and better. Today, a new fine-tuned model is released every 6 minutes. Holy crap. You know, the idea, there was so much discussion about, like, you know, this was going to be closed. You know, like, this, these were going to be huge corporate centralized AI. And while those are there, a fine-tuned model is released every 6 minutes. We are already talking about millions, hundreds of millions of different fine-tunes of different specific use cases and applications for these things. And I still think we don't understand where and how to use these. But Grok 1, the model waste, like I was saying, Grok 1 is now open source. And it is a definitely designed to compete with, you know, ChatGPT. It is a 314 billion parameter model, and it is also a mixture of experts. So it's very much like Mixtral, and also ChatGPT. Pretty much all of the big models, I'm like 99% sure now, are pretty much a mixture of experts across the board, because it's just the most efficient way to get the highest output, the highest results. But this is a 314 billion parameter model that is open. Now, it's just like free to use, free to fine tune. I also used it in comparison because I've had access to it for a while, and I play with it quite a bit. I use it more than anything, really, to kind of get something useful out of Twitter without having to get stuck in the feed or get it to do things like that. Like, I used it during the collection of my notes and stuff for this episode, is trying to find specific tweets and stuff about these news items and going down these threads, these little rabbit holes and connections. It helps me find those things without getting lost in, you know, unnecessary comments or things that aren't really relevant. But Brian Romelli posted almost immediately that they, as well as other people, were like, immediately they are quantizing this thing so that you can run it on smaller machines, and you can run, you know, far more compressed versions of this. And I'm going to try to figure out, because it's such a big model, it's going to be really interesting to look at, like, you know, kind of like 32 billion, like 32B and 60B, whatever, model versions of this. And I'm going to see just how big a one that I can get to run without just taking, you know, 80 years to come up with a result on my own little AI machine here. But Grok is great because it has a lot less guards up. You know, like, it has a lot less rails around what it can do. It can, especially from a personality context, and, you know, if you were trying to get an LLM to curse or have some sort of, you know, being trained on Twitter, it just kind of has it's a far more broad and more let you kind of control and guide what degree you want it to engage in certain things. And I think it will probably make it a really, really good one to loosen the chains on even further with fine tuning and how people will actually use this in a lot of other contexts. And it's also pretty good at writing code. I've been using so many of these different things to make these micro apps, and I've been trying to compare each one of them. I'm increasingly surprised. I keep wondering, are any of these LLMs ever built without really like trained on a lot of code? And I think maybe the kind of database of stuff and the incredible volume of things that are available on GitHub just makes it easy to build small things and to make sure that like every good LLM has a coding specific expert within it. You know, in the mixture of experts, one of them writes code, it just is going to be the norm. And I think that's freaking great, because in fact, oh my god, here's another great example. Actually, for those of you who haven't watched the Devs Who Can't Code series, I highly recommend it, because it is YouTube only, obviously, because it is video. But I recommend it specifically because I think people discount all that they can do with LLMs, with these models. And so a good example, actually, is I was saying that my Linux machine is open and I'm looking at like just an entire folder of just models. And one of the things that I've run into, especially with the image diffusion and video generation and control net and all of these things, is that you'll notice like with Invoke AI, with Comfy UI, with Automatic 1111, all of these different things have their own configuration files. They have their own folder structure with like outputs and inputs and all of this crap. And so you have to have models in the folder specific to that program. So like you know, if you're using image diffusion models and you want to use Invoke, you want to use Focus, you want to use Automatic 1111, you want to use Comfy UI, whatever you're using, you still have to have it within the folder of that thing. So one of the things that I did, just so I'm not using up, like if I have a crap ton of models, I got like 100 gigs worth of models in without breaking a sweat, because I'll just get, you know, Stable XL is 7 gigs. So if you've got like 10 models, you're pushing that, you're pushing just tons of data in trying to have these things. And if you have to have them in multiple places, because something like Automatic 1111 is really great interface, and what you're supposed to be able to, and I tried and I got it to work for a little bit, but then for some reason just stopped working. I didn't change anything, but it stopped working. No idea why. Is that you can put in the configuration files that you can direct it to a different folder as to where your models are. So I was putting it in my Comfy UI folder, where they put their checkpoints, and then changing the configuration file, the .config file, which is not something that an average user is going to be able to do in Automatic 1111, to get it to look in the Comfy folder for the models so that I could have it in one place and both applications could use it. But I could not do this with Invoke. It doesn't appear that I can use it for Focus. But here's the thing, is I actually solved the problem with AI. So I used ChatGPT and Claude until I ran out of context with Claude in my free version, and I'm going to have to either use my other free account or start paying for it. I'm also going to be interested. I tried it with Grok, and Grok wrote almost the same code, like very, very similar code. I didn't actually run it to see if it would work, because I ran into a bunch of I had to iterate like 4 or 5 times. ChatGPT did not give me working code out the gate. But there's something called like everybody knows about shortcuts, right? Or an alias on Mac, is you can put a pointer to a file in a different location. Well, if you ever notice that an application will not use the pointer, so in the context of like Automatic 1111, if you put shortcuts in the models folder, Automatic 1111 doesn't read the shortcut. It doesn't know it's there. But there's something deeper. If you're, you know, do Linux administration or something, and you're pretty familiar, a little bit familiar with the terminal, you probably know about symlinks, which is a deeper level link to where the file is in the file system, such that an application can look at it and not realize that they're actually being directed to a different location on the drive, that it's not the same place in the file system. So you can actually do this with those models. And then I have models with metadata and previews and all sorts of stuff, and other details in like text files and JSON files to go with them. So I manually was like ln-s and then was starting to make symlinks. Ln is how you make a symlink, is the file, it's the command in terminal. And then moving it to the other location in Pinocchio, which is the program I have that's letting me run all of these inside of a program. And I did that like for just a handful of them. And I was like, wow, this is stupid. This is going to take me forever. And I was like, wait a second. Obviously, I could build a tiny app and I could create tons of symlinks automatically for an entire folder. And so I did that. Like I said, it's 4 or 5 iterations. But what I was able to do is I now have a little app, and it uses, what's it called, Zenity or Zenify, for like a little like UI, like really minimal thing that just lets me select a folder on the inside of a window rather than actually have to use the terminal. So I can basically just double click on this thing and ask me for an input folder, and then I give it an output folder, and then boom, it just makes symlinks. And what it does, or what this allows me to do, just so you can get the idea of why I did this, because I have so many of these different interfaces and different ways that I'm using these models, I now have an AI folder that has LLMs, that has ControlNet stuff and depth map models and video models and image generation models and all of these different things laid out, like basically all of the different interfaces and tools, put like VIEs and LoRAs and all of these things. They kind of have like a formal list, like everybody has the same type of things, and they have their own little versions of it and their own little file hierarchy. Well, I have one folder on my Linux machine where I just put all of the things. I don't put any of them in the automatic 1111, any of the company UI, any of those things. And I can just put it all in just a big, these are all the AI things, which is like 500 gigabytes of stuff now. And I put them all in this one folder, and then I can just copy, I can just run this little script, I can run this little application and have it make symlinks for everything in the folder and put all those symlinks into the comfy UI checkpoints folder. And I can put all the symlinks into the models folder, which is the same thing, but just a different name, models folder for Stable Diffusion or for automatic 1111. And I can do it for info. I can do it for all of these. And then I can just work with the symlinks, and none of the files actually go to where any of these applications are. And then I get an additional benefit. Not only do I have one repository for all of my models and all of the things that I'm working with, but I get an additional benefit in the fact that I can easily delete and reinstall and just wipe all of the programs that I have, and I don't have to worry about losing any of my models or any of the stuff that I did, because I put it in a repository that has nothing to do with any of the applications. So all of the application information is basically just application information. It's none of the work that I've done around it. Granted, I guess, you know, outputs still go to like their base folders, and maybe I'll figure something else, something out there. But nonetheless, it's another one of those use cases for LLMs that I think is just really, really fascinating, especially when we have another really big model like Grok that's very capable, that is now open source and can be used to modify it, to make it better at code and to build these sorts of things. Guys, if you're not, I mean, I just did this just a little while ago. I did this in just, it didn't take long. I did it between episodes. I recorded like 2 reads today. I've been like killing it on Bitcoin Audible and then hitting AI Unchained. And I did this between shows. I built this and I solved this problem for me. And I think this is kind of a good microcosm of the idea that this intelligence is going to be ubiquitous. Like the number of things that I have access to, like I'm just an enthusiast. Like I don't build this stuff. I haven't even fine-tuned a model. This stuff is just cool to me. So I kind of collect. I collect and I play. And then I make a show about it and I tell you guys about what I'm doing. And people don't realize just how potent you can be with these tools. And also don't think about it in the context of like, you're going to lose your job, or you're not going to be able to do graphic design. Like, quite the opposite. It just, like, I'm constantly having to delegate because there's only so much time that I can actually commit myself to things. This is why I have a team for all of the shows that I'm doing now. And thank God I do, because I'd never be able to scale and just accomplish all of these shows and the output that I have. We have basically more than, we have an episode every single day of multiple shows and then video work on top of it, short form video and long form video. Like, the output now from our little enterprise is crazy. And we're basically like a 3-man, 4-man team. But you know what? Every time I figure out how to do something with an LLM or do something with an image model, or I have an account with Midjourney or whatever, I give it to my graphics person. I give it to my producer. And I show them how to do it so that they can do more with their time. I'm not replacing their jobs. I'm making them 10x more capable in their job so that he can use, so my producer can use LLMs to, you know, pull together descriptions for the show and do automatic transcripts and all of that sort of stuff, because it saves him time. It saves him time and it saves me time, or it saves me money in the amount of capacity that we can, in our output, our ability to produce output. And that was something else that I mentioned in the Guy Swan Network, now on Keat. If you guys haven't checked out Keat yet, I'm making the broadcast channel, the Guy Swan Network, basically a central hub where I'm going to blast out everything that I'm working on and all of my content, because it's something that I totally control, in the sense that, like, the data is there. The data is mine. It can't be censored. And I'm going to lean into this heavily. I'm going to be using the Pear Stack way, way more. I'm going to be using Keat way more. And if you want to get in the broadcast channel and get basically access and be able to watch any and everything that I do, it is all going to be posted there. But I was talking about how I've found Claude 3 by Anthropic AI is increasingly a really good competitor to ChatGPT. And one of the things that I've noticed specifically, and this is what I mean when I was referencing that I give this to my producer in order to increase the output here, is one thing. I mean, so many little things have just saved, God knows, just incredible amounts of time. And one of the things that I've done, so I've got the video on YouTube, for those who haven't seen it, of building a little app that automatically transcribes my podcast. That's been a godsend. I have the little app that does my automatic archiving. Jesus Christ, the amount of time it has saved, and the number of times that I have not run into a bottleneck of running out of hard drive space on my Mac Pro because I can so automatically and easily archive stuff. Good God. This has already saved me at least 5 days, maybe 10 days worth of strict recording. Because when I run into that bottleneck, when I run out of hard drive space again, which I do every month, I still hit the rim, so to speak. I hit the limit. Then I run my archiving thing, and I can continue working, and it starts cleaning up and archiving all of my stuff, so I get all of my space back. I've gained somewhere between 5 and 10 days back that I would have lost, that would have just taken me a whole day of trying to move files around. But another great one, this is very specific and targeted use case, is a simple little prompt that I have about writing descriptions for an episode. Like, I will do this for this episode. And I don't ever actually use, I always try to make it my voice, and I often don't like the tone or the kind of the way some of the things are worded, and like the arbitrary sort of like term paper sounding elements that ChatGPT will add into it. But just for a general purpose, if you, for getting a description, I'll say, like, give me 2-sentence description of this episode or of the transcript of this episode, which, again, the transcript is, I do with a drag and drop, so then I just pull that into ChatGPT or into Claude, and then I have the exact same prompt. I say I want a 2-sentence description that covers what we talk about in this show, and I want you to frame a question relevant to it such that if I asked the question, the podcast would be the answer to that question. And then the other big thing that I have, because I'm not sure if anybody's listened to Bitcoin Audible since way back when, a couple of years ago, you'll notice something that I would always say, I'll put a link in the show notes to this thing, and then that link would not end up in the show notes. And the reason why is because I will forget. I'll get in a rant or go on my guys take rambling, winding roads, and I'll completely forget that I mentioned something or that I mentioned like a book. Like Bullshit Jobs is a great example. I mean, I won't forget about it now that I've just brought it up, but I won't have to remember it because the AI will do that for me. So the next part of my prompt is also, if I mentioned any books, products, or specific websites or articles in the show for people to check out, can you list those out and so that I can find the links for all of those so I can get them and I don't forget them? And inevitably, every other episode, it pulls a link out of the conversation that either I didn't even think about to put in the description. Sometimes I mention offhand some book that I'm listening to or the book on the topic, and then I don't even think, oh, I got to remember to put that in the description. Like, it will pull stuff like that out of the conversation and be like, well, you mentioned this. Do you want to put a link in the link for that? And so not only does it pull those out, but every single time I have specifically mentioned something, it almost invariably catches it. However, on that same note, Claude, why do I can't keep saying that a little odd? Claude has actually done a better job of finding my links. It's a little subjective as to whether or not the description is better for Claude or GPT. The one thing I've noticed for GPT that Claude doesn't do is if I ask for two sentences, GPT might give me four. And it'll be like a really long paragraph and I'll have to cut it down because I don't want it to be too lengthy. And a lot of the times ChatGPT will give me really kind of on the nose questions. And I like a little bit more abstract, a little bit more esoteric, like in the sense that I don't want to ask a question where the answer is in the question. Like, I actually want it to be something where if somebody is curious about this idea, I don't, like kind of in a movie trailer, you don't want to give too much away. You're going to be like, is the killer really, really the waiter? Like, that's the kind of question that ChatGPT asks. Whereas in a movie trailer, if you want to build suspense and get people to entice them to actually watch the movie, you don't say who the killer is. You just put up all the suspects and you put up all the complexities and the contradictions in the case where it doesn't seem to fit anybody, and then you say, who's the killer? And if you had ChatGPT write that for you, they'd be like, did the waiter kill him, and did he do it this way? Find out by watching our movie. And I found that Claude actually seems a little bit better at both being succinct, and, like, if I ask it for two sentences, it will give me two sentences, and then also at framing the question with a distance, like at arm's length, in the way far more closely to the way I would want for like a movie trailer. But I've never actually been able to use the description completely. It still feels a bit like an LLM, and sometimes the perspective, like the voice, or like third person sort of thing, the voice of the LLM is too odd. It's just like, in this episode with Guy Swan and Der Gigi, we talk about blah, blah, blah. And it's weird. I don't like that in my description. But anyway, it's a huge time saver because it will hit the points. I will forget that I've gone on, a 15-minute tangent about some particular idea, and it will add that into the description, and then it will trigger something that I talked about or a point that I really, really liked and I wanted to bring attention to, and that might not have ended up in the description had I not done it this way. And because of that, I don't have to sit there and think about what the show was, because as I said, when I'm trying to scale this up and we've got like four people working on all of this, and I'm banging out episodes and shows on multiple different topics, I don't even remember which show I covered stuff on sometimes. Like, I'll forget that I went down this whole rabbit hole on AI Unchained, and I'll think it was in an interview with Preston Pish on Bitcoin Audible or something. Like, I won't even know where the hell I'm going with some stuff because I just, I jump back and forth from different project to different project. Like I said, in between two episode recordings, I'll do some video stuff, or I'll edit, or I'll just randomly decide that it's time to build an app, a micro app, to manage a central hub of all of my LLMs and image diffusion and video models. So that lends itself to forgetting what I've done a lot. And if I did not write the description immediately following recording the episode and I try to come back to it, I'll completely forget what the good stuff in the episode was. Or I'll just be like, oh, well, I know what the article's about, but what the hell did I talk about in the guy's take? So the ability to quickly find and pinpoint those elements and, you know, kind of shortcut towards a description is just huge for being able to organize a broad scope of projects and things that you're doing, because the AI can fill in. It is like kind of this central, okay, we can all kind of utilize it, additional employee on our team that can just do stuff insanely quickly and is always there to ask questions to. Now, I've really kind of gone on a whole bunch of tangents here and just talked about, in general, a lot of things. And there's actually some news items that I wanted to hit. So I'm actually going to kind of run through the list of these things just so we cover them for this episode, because this has already gotten kind of long. But it looks like Apple is going to be entering the AI space very soon. And I know, obviously, they've got Siri and they've been using machine learning a lot. In fact, the interesting thing about Apple's situation is that so much of their AI is really subtle. It's very under the surface. Like, one of the things that I'll notice, you may not know this. In fact, you know, even myself trying to pay attention to where I notice machine learning tools and AI being integrated with stuff, this is still something that I didn't know until pretty recently. Recently being like a year, is the ability to search images on your Mac or on your phone contextually. I was looking for this the other day, and what's funny is that the only picture that I was looking for is the one that it didn't catch, and it kind of makes sense because it was basically the exact same color of the wood, and I almost didn't see it myself. So the machine learning is not better than the human recognition, apparently. But I went, and I was trying to show somebody this, but I take a lot of pictures. As a filmmaker at heart and also a dad of the cutest nearly two-year-old child on the face of the planet. And I know you think your child is cute, and no disrespect, but mine's cuter. And I just, you need to know that. But because of that, I have a lot of video and a lot of pictures on my phone. So if I'm trying to find something, like a picture that I took 3 days ago or last week or something, it's not easy to find. Not to mention that I save memes, and now I take screenshots of articles or clips or quotes because I know I can actually search for the quote in the image. And that's the powerful thing, is that if you go to the search bar, if you like pull down and go to the search bar in iOS in your photos, and you contextually look for something, if you say bike, if you say snake, it will literally find pictures with a bike in it or with a snake in it. Or if you look for a specific word or a specific name and you took a picture of a quote with that person's name or with that word in it, it will look through the text and it will show that in your search result. So the reason I bring up snake specifically is because that's what I was looking for. Every once in a while, I'll find these little baby snakes in our yard. In fact, I had the, for a long time, because our backyard wasn't even finished, it wasn't fenced in anything, I had a water hose sitting out, just kind of like open, and hadn't used it for anything. And I literally like pulled it out of the grass that had like grown up around it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so irresponsible. It's just been sitting out here like trash in my backyard. And I plugged it into the water, the spigot, because I needed it. And when I turned the water on, like four baby snakes came out of it. I had just ruined their perfect, safe, nobody ever messes with it cave. How could there ever be a problem here? Because this is clearly forgotten about and this is our perfect little home. And I felt a little bit bad about it. But I mean, they all survived, and they were all basically rat snakes of some form or fashion. And, you know, I found a bunch of snakes around, and I end up taking pictures, like, show my wife. I was like, oh, my God, I found a snake. That's so cool. And I had one the other day, and I literally searched for snake in my photos. I've never labeled any of these images at all, and it found every snake picture that I had ever taken, except for the one that I took recently that was right in front of the door to my basement where I come down here in the studio when I'm working, and I have a board right in front of it, and it just, I really think it's just because it was, like, hidden. It was camouflaged really well into the board, and I almost stepped on it. So that's a really powerful tool if you have not used it or realized that that is there in Mac. Apple has been using AI for a long time. It's just not very obvious. It's not super clear. Obviously, they've been doing the face thing as well. You can, like, label that this is my wife, this is me, this is Guy, and then it will find all the pictures with you in it, and it's gotten pretty damn good at that, too. But Siri has always sucked. And it's amazing that if Siri worked like chat, I mean, obviously, Siri was intended to be ChatGPT. It, like, the point of it was it for it to be that good. And now that we are in kind of the age of large language models, and we clearly have AI assistants that can do all of these things, and we can integrate these things, it's fascinating to see that Apple has not yet entered the game. They are still sitting on stage left, and they have not come out with what they are doing, which makes me think in AI and in Apple fashion, they are waiting for it to do exactly what they were waiting for, that UX. I mean, they were basically ahead of the game when it came to AI, thinking that Siri was going to be a really powerful tool. But it was just crappy enough that it just really didn't help. And with something like the Rabbit, the R1 Rabbit, for those of you who haven't seen that, I actually ordered one, and the first batch is actually going out now. And I think I will be in the first batch, if I'm not mistaken, so I'm pretty excited about getting it. And it might be a completely unnecessary device. It was decent price point. It was just $200, which in one context, all that's expensive. But in another context, it's not really that bad when you think about what it is and what it could potentially be. But it's essentially what Siri ought to have been, right? Or what Siri dreams to have been. And they have something called a large action model. And the fascinating potential prospect of this is that you can train it to use applications it doesn't know how to do. And they show it actively, perfect example being Discord and Midjourney. So they used it literally to generate an image. And what they did is they said, you know, watch this, like watch me, learn from me in a setting on their computer. And then they went through and they opened up Discord or Midjourney or whatever, and they typed in a prompt and they gave the specific details and they got the image and they saved the image. And then they said, you know, stop listening or stop watching. And now they went to their R1, to their little device, which is kind of like a mixture of a pseudo walkie-talkie tiny square screen thing that you talk to like an AI. It's your little AI rabbit. But they went to this thing and they now said, all right, make me, at using Midjourney, make me an image, generate me an image of a rabbit or something. I can't remember exactly what they did. And it literally did the same actions that the user had just done to go through the Discord, generate the image, pick the best image, and then save it. And then boom, it popped up on that little device. And you didn't see any of this action taking place. It was doing it entirely in the background. And supposed promise of this device is that you're going to be able to book flights with it. It's going to be able to, you know, go through processes on websites, and it's a large action model. It is going to literally be able to do things for you like an assistant. Now, I'm going to see, we'll do an episode about it, and I'll probably do a video as well on YouTube just to see how good it is at accomplishing that. Might be a completely wasted purchase, but it's just kind of cool to, like I said, I'm nerd out on this stuff super hard, and I love exploring these. But I think with Apple kind of having something like that as a competitor, as a juxtaposition for what they can do. I can't imagine that they are now announcing, they are now saying that they're going to have big announcements with AI. It seems like one of their, probably their iOS 18 update is going to have a lot of AI stuff built in. And I can't imagine they would do that and not have something that makes them think they're going to look like the best or the most application useful, the most useful application of AI. And that's one of the things that if Apple keeps this mentality, and something that Apple does really well is that they don't work from this is a cool technology, how do we get customers to use it? How do we figure out like what would be useful for a customer? They go from the customer, what does the customer need? What's useful for the customer? And how do we make, and is this technology useful in creating that? So, and they're usually very, very good at that. Say what you will about them, but I think it is dishonest to say that they don't kill it on that front. Now, it kind of stands, you know, we will find out probably pretty soon with their AI position, but it's definitely something to keep an eye out for, because this will be the year of everyone basically coming up with their quote-unquote large action model, their AI assistant that doesn't suck. The era of AI assistants that are actually good at their job and can actually do those things that an assistant can do is upon us. It will be this year. So I would keep a very, very close eye on Apple. My one caveat and the one really frustrating thing is that it's probably going to be as woke or as neutered or as stupidly choked for no reason on things that it should obviously be able to do as something like Google Gemini. Like the embarrassment that was Google Gemini was actually hilarious, honestly. But the fact that it was so blatantly racist and just comedy gold for all the stuff that happened. And this is like a perfect example of like the corporate environment just ties your hands. And so while there's something probably really exciting to talk about, and maybe there's going to be a really cool thing with Apple in their, you know, AI product, probably at the same time, depending on how well they execute this, they could also be a bit of an embarrassment, and it could also not be able to do some of the things that you would just want it to do, like look up controversial political issues, basic things that you would want to investigate since something is explicitly controversial. And who knows, Siri might quote unquote protect us from all of that. But it looks like their worldwide developer conference for this year will finally see the iPhone have a massive AI jump. Apple will be entering the AI space. And for better or worse, I think that's pretty exciting. All right, another news item, another development actually with Stability AI, which I didn't mention, is they now have a stable code, 3B, which is actually a pretty small, I haven't really explored it much yet, but this was like released just a couple of days ago. But it's a small model that apparently kind of rivals Code Llama for the 7B model. And as I've said, I don't know how many times, I think these are the most valuable. This is where the biggest output expansion lies, like the biggest value add, especially for technical people that do not develop. If you can build yourself a micro app, this is a sort of thing. And because it's a 3B model, it's actually a pretty small model, it will probably run on, like, it'll run on a MacBook, like, without a doubt. Especially if you have, like, one of the M series, like, a lot of these just kind of cruise. So if you're looking to build, like, really simple little things and you want a model that will be really, really fast and work on a typical computer, this is probably a really good one to check out. Another thing on, you can use Ollama, LM Studio, or Prim, or any of these, some of the ones that I've mentioned in previous episodes for running your local LLMs. Any of those should work. Still, probably my favorite is LM Studio. Olama is increasingly becoming one of my favorites. I don't know what it is, but I love things that work in the terminal, and it's also easy to use a CLI with other applications. So if you're building applications to use it, LM Studio does have an API, like, so you can do it locally. But I don't know, I've increasingly really, really liked Olama. So that's just a note. Now, actually, going back to the idea of the machine learning and stuff that they have in Apple and like iOS in identifying stuff in images, is Google has released, Google AI has released something called Video Prism, which is a classifier, a local classifier for like captioning, for retrieval, and question answering for video. So again, this is one of those things where like the tools for being able to analyze what's going on in a video, and potentially I still haven't found the secret sauce for this, but one of the micro apps that I really, really want to build and that I will share with you guys the second I figure it out, or I get it workable in such a way that like I'm going to use it for everything I freaking do, is the ability for a image model to look at an image, a multimodal model to look at an image, pull out a description, and then give me, basically make a file format for its title, for the file name, that has, you know, some core element of what it is for searching, and then like six important tags for what I would search with it, or what I would search in order to find it, like whether it's a meme or whether it's a screenshot or what, you know, is said in the text or the post, or you know, what the object is, that sort of thing, to be able to do that in the file name, so that I basically have multiple layers to search. And what's the topic? You know, there's a lot of times where I'll do stuff and I'll be like, you know, this is politics. This is something I'm saving about the government being corrupt, or, you know, a stupid regulation that backfired and now costs 10 times as much and the results have all plummeted. Everything got worse. Or it's something about AI or Bitcoin or the Pear Stack. God knows what. Anything that I'm doing with one of my shows, there's just so much to keep up with. And if I can save stuff without having to name it, without having to name and organize it myself, I've actually gotten to where I think I'm close enough to a solution that it's going to be easy, that I don't even name files anymore. I've gotten to where I'm just starting to dump them. And that's after having come up with like a really solid naming convention and thinking I was being really good at organizing. I think I'm going to figure this out. So I will keep you guys abreast of my progress in this project, because I think this will be super, super valuable. And it looks like I haven't had one for video yet, and Google has released Video Prism. So I'm going to be hopefully being able to test this out. Don't know if it's going to be local run or anything. I just kind of have really vague details on it at this moment. But, you know, at this point, I've still got a couple of news items, but they're not nearly as cool. And one of them might actually require an episode just on digging into how this actually works and some of the ways that they're combining models together. It's an interesting new methodology, apparently, for combining the models quicker and with less computation. So I'm curious to dig further into that. So I don't want to cover too much on it now since it's really vague. I would like to have some specifics so I feel like I'm not an idiot telling you about something that I don't really know about. So we will stop this one here. And really the big news, I think, is kind of the perspective and change with Stability AI and why it seems like momentum, something is shifting. Something in the undertone of the ecosystem is shifting. And I hope, but also just kind of from what I'm seeing and what seems to make sense to me, the decentralized AI itself is becoming disconnected from the infrastructure. And I think the more and more we move in this direction, the more and more hope I have for AI being an incredible tool for liberty, for sovereignty, and for us having control over our own environments, over our own data, and over our own little environment and ecosystem and productive capacity. And I think that is a beautiful and amazing thing. And I am 100% here for it. So don't forget to check out the YouTube channel with so many other things, Devs Who Can't Code. Don't forget to check out Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite, the supporters of the show. Don't forget to boost us on Fountain or get paid sats. I think I'm going to boost my marketing thing for this show. So you might be able to get paid sats to listen to AI Unchained. So do it. Check it out. Get on Fountain. It's fountain.fm. If you haven't seen it, highly, highly recommend it. And thank you all for supporting the show. Thank you all for sharing it out. You guys are what make this work. So I love you all. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys.